Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In last year's elections, many voters said they were tired of the U.S. being the world's policeman, that it was time for us to focus on our own problems and pull back from the world stage. But 70 years ago, the nation felt otherwise, fearing the international spread of communism in the wake of World War II. And so in March of 1947, President Harry Truman offered a response to those fears. In a speech to Congress, Truman asked for funds to help the nation of Greece facing what he called terrorist activities led by communists. But Truman sounded a broader theme as well, concerns about the Soviet Union's rising power.
More than a frank recognition that totalitarian regimes imposed upon free peoples by direct or indirect aggression undermine the foundations of international peace and hence the security of the United States.
The speech became known as the Truman Doctrine. It's now seen as the beginning of the Cold War and the point where America became a global superpower. Today in The Exchange, the Truman Doctrine, 70 years old. Is it still relevant or is it history? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests. William Woolforth joins us from Dartmouth. He's a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He's co-author of the book America Abroad, The United States' Global Role in the 21st Century. And Professor Woolforth, welcome back. Good to have you.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us in studio, Kirk Dorsey, professor of history at UNH. And Professor Dorsey, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
It's very good to see you, Laura.
So let's start out, guys, just very broadly. The Berlin Wall has fallen. No more Soviet Union. Today, the threat seems to come from terrorist groups. And Americans have elected a president who campaigned on pulling back from the world stage. How much relevance, then, is there, Kirk? What do you think, to this Truman Doctrine?
Well, I think it's very relevant. It's run foreign policy for the last 70 years, mostly. And I think even many of the people within the Trump administration are still committed to it, even if Trump himself is not entirely sure whether or not he's committed to the Truman Doctrine. If you look at just this idea that Americans have that the president is a leader of the free world.
We often hear that. Leader of the free world.
That. That really comes from the Truman Doctrine speech and from the acceptance of the American people of the speech. And I think it's important to remember that the Truman Doctrine speech was not inevitable. Not only was there a debate within the administration, but Truman himself was by no means an inevitable president. The vice president before him was Henry Wallace, and Henry Wallace was taken off the ticket in 1944 because he was considered too liberal, and Harry Truman was placed on the ticket. And then, of course, FDR died. Harry Truman became president, and Wallace stayed on as Commerce Secretary. And in 1946, in fall of 1946, Wallace was fired for giving a speech that said the United States was encircling the Soviet Union and that the United States was provoking the Soviet Union. He easily could have been president of the United States with a very different worldview than the one Truman framed in March of 1947.
Okay, so Wallace could have been president if he had not been removed from the ticket.
Yes.
Came within a hair's breadth of becoming vice president.
Yes.
And you're saying, Kirk, that he had a very different way of looking at the American role than Harry Truman did.
Absolutely. And the speech he gave, which Truman approved after not reading very carefully, in Madison Square Garden got wide coverage. And he basically laid out a worldview that was remarkably similar to the worldview that the Soviet ambassador in Washington was reporting back to Moscow, that the United States was remilitarizing and had bases around the world. And Wallace was saying if we tried to look at the struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union from the Soviet standpoint, we would see that the United States was the aggressor. And that did not play well with American diplomats who were negotiating with the Soviets at that time. And Truman was forced to fire him. But he easily could have been president in 1945 and then into 1947.
That's amazing. And I did not know that. So you learn something new every day. What do you think, Bill, the idea that this 70-year-old doctrine is still, to some extent, as Kirk says, guiding our foreign policy?
Well, it's highly relevant in that the normal state of affairs for the United States is not to be involved in the world, and Truman Doctrine marks this huge change. Indeed, when he articulated, and he and his administration articulated the argument for our need to get involved, they kind of, I think historians would agree, hyped the threat a little bit, feeling they needed to shock the Americans into accepting this new global role. And Stalin, back in Moscow, at least from 1945 and into 1946, was working on the assumption the United States would do what it did after World War I. It would come back home and do and tend to its own garden. And there were deep, deep wellsprings in the United States of political ideology and political interests and viewpoints that argued that is the proper role for the United States, to tend to its own garden. So this was a huge and momentous change. And as Kirk noted, it's really marked and affected the world for the last 70 years. And we can argue over whether it's been good for the world, whether it's been good for the United States. There's no doubt about it, though, that the world we see today, the one we live in, is in very significant part a consequence of that decision from 70 years ago.
So what do you mean by he exaggerated? I think that's the word you use, Bill.
We now know that the Soviet Union was in no position to do to conduct an actual invasion of Western Europe. We know that the Soviet Union was weakened. It had suffered 30 million casualties, 17 million soldiers killed in the Second World War. It was not in powerful shape. We knew very well that there wasn't an imminent invasion. And we also knew, we had intelligence to know that the communist threat, while it was very, very serious, was far more variegated, not entirely and thoroughly and perfectly directed from the Kremlin. But we did feel the need to prevent certain moves Stalin was contemplating in the Black Sea area and the Mediterranean, and we felt the need to gin up support because we did feel, the American intelligence and policymaking community did feel, that if we didn't move now, a few years down the road, the West and the U.S. and its allies would be, its emerging allies would be in a very, very bad situation. So a lot of the Cold War, a lot of this stuff that the United States does, going all the way back to the Truman Doctrine, is about preventing bad things from happening in the future. But to make the case to a skeptical public, sometimes policymakers frame the threat as being more immediate than they know it actually is.
Let's hear Harry Truman himself frame that threat, as you put it.
It is necessary only to glance at a map to realize that the survival and integrity of the Greek nation are of grave importance in a much wider situation. If Greece should fall under the control of an armed minority, the effect upon its neighbor Turkey would be immediate and serious. Confusion and disorder might well spread throughout the entire Middle East. Moreover, the disappearance of Greece as an independent state would have a profound effect upon those countries in Europe whose peoples are struggling against great difficulties to maintain their freedoms and their independence while they repair the damages of war.
Again, that's Harry Truman, March of 1947, in a speech that became known as the Truman Doctrine. That's what we're looking at today in the exchange, this doctrine of making America a global superpower. And both our guests say it is still highly relevant today. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at nhpr exchange. Again, you can give us a call with your questions or comments about this doctrine and how it's still with us today. 1-800-892-6477. So, Kirk, just to explain to people, in that clip, he talks about Greece. So just remind us, that was the immediate concern.
Greece and Turkey were the immediate concerns, and he used those as the inroad to a larger statement about America's role in the world. He ends his speech very powerfully by saying, in effect, I'm only asking for $400 million, and if I don't get it, we will have thrown away the $341 billion we spent on World War II. And so he very cleverly tied the chaos in Greece, which was only loosely, as he described it, a product of outside intervention. It was more a product of internal problems in Greece. And the threat to Turkey was actually very minimal at that time. He defined those countries as free and therefore part of the free world, and the rest of the world was unfree, and that's what the United States had been fighting for, was the free world. The speech is fascinating because he says Greece isn't perfect, But he sort of covered up where the trouble in Greece was coming from. As Bill suggested, he said that the armed minority was being armed by the Soviets. They're actually being armed by the Yugoslavs, who were also communists, but were at that time struggling with the Soviet Union over ideological issues. So it was not Stalin actually interfering directly in Greece. It was much more of a Greek internal civil war that he was intervening on. And the Greek government was by no means really a free government. It was a monarchy, for one thing.
So, and in the speech, he goes into great detail about, you know, this is a free and fair election, and, you know, it's not perfect, but these are democratic peoples.
Yes.
And, I mean, he really makes it sound like a shining example of democracy that needs to be upheld.
And I think it was easy for him to sell Greece as a country of the shining democracy,
right,
given the long traditions,
Athens,
and that once we settled this problem, Greece would be able to go back to being a democratic state. But there really wasn't a tradition at that point of an independent Greek democratic state, and certainly not in Turkey either. So he, when Bill was talking about maybe not telling the whole truth, to frame Greece and Turkey as members of the free world and democratic states in 1947, that was twisting the truth a little bit to make his larger point.
So, Bill, why did he do that? I mean, just to hear Kirk talk, I'm thinking, okay, if it wasn't as bad as, or as, if the situation wasn't quite as how he described it, why did he do that?
The big context was that the United States and the Soviet Union could not agree on a peace settlement in Germany, and that's, in some sense, the immediate cause of the Cold War. And it's a complicated series of events that we study and we argue about and probably will be forever. It's funny, we have this show today because just yesterday in my Russian foreign policy class, we were talking about exactly these events and the different interpretations of Soviet motives and U.S. motives. But the bottom line is, Stalin had already started to see that, you know, he probably wasn't going to get cooperation. He wasn't going to be able to maintain cooperation with the West. And he started to make a bunch of moves all around the world, essentially to try to create, you know, the maximal possible security situation for his country. It included all of these Eastern European countries that would ultimately be Sovietized. It included an enclave in northern Iran. He was looking for oil. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there we can look at, but the big point of it is he's seeing the post-war situation as a situation as an opportunity to maximize his security. He's starting to see that the U.S. is actually going to probably stay as an adversary. He doesn't foresee permanent bases of U.S. troops as ultimately happened, but he sees it's going to be an adversary and he wants to maximize his position. The problem was, and the context for the speech is, that the West was in terrible shape. I mean, Western Europe, devastated by the war, huge refugee problems, a massive lack of confidence, and in truth, communist parties were quite popular in many areas as having stood up to the Nazis during the war. People had already forgotten or chose to forget about the Nazi-Soviet pact. And so they had real concern that without buttressing the willpower and the elan and the sense of faith in the future of these states, that they would potentially fall prey to not direct Soviet armies romping over the border, but to political movements that would be favorable to the Soviet Union that would then leave Europe entirely in the hands of a hostile global superpower. And that was just an outcome that was quite scary to contemplate from a U.S. perspective, having just suffered a major world war from a very aggressive state. So these were preventive moves, but they were very expansive in their implementation on both the U.S. and the Soviet sides, and the result was what we came to know as the Cold War.
Well, and we forget sometimes how devastated Europe was after the war, and that Truman's speech is in part in response to this. As he says famously, you know, the seeds of totalitarianism grow well in poverty and chaos. Let's just hear him describe, making the case to Congress about why Greece really needed that help.
When forces of liberation entered Greece, they found that the retreating Germans had destroyed virtually all the railways, roads, port facilities, communications, and merchant marine. More than 1,000 villages had been burned. 85% of the children were tubercular. Livestock, poultry, and draft animals had almost disappeared. Inflation had wiped out practically all savings. As a result of these tragic conditions, a militant minority exploiting human want and misery was able to create political chaos, which until now has made economic recovery impossible.
So there he is, Kirk Dorsey, saying, look how terrible this is, and economic recovery is impossible, and a militant minority is taking advantage of this, a.k.a., you know, communists.
Yes, and we should keep in mind that just a few months later, in June of 1947, George Marshall, the Secretary of State, went to Harvard and laid out the Marshall Plan, which directly was supposed to address this problem of economic chaos. And as historians discovered as they went through the data, Marshall Plan aid went predominantly to countries where there was a strong threat of communism. And so they wanted to try to check, as Truman said, the seeds of communism that they found. And as Bill said, they weren't particularly worried that the Red Army was going to come storming across through to West Germany into France, but they were very concerned that they might lose the free elections in Western Europe. We know, for instance, that the CIA intervened in the 1948 election in Italy to try to undermine the communists and help make sure they did not win that election. But there was fear, particularly in France, that the French elections would go to communists. In fact, Charles de Gaulle used the chance of a French communist victory as an argument as early as 1945, before the war was even over, that the United States had to support him getting back into Vietnam, that France should reclaim Vietnam, because if they lost the empire, then the nationalists would have almost nothing to stand on, and the communists would win the election, and they'd lose France. So he basically told Truman, you can lose France or you can lose Vietnam, which one, and Truman, of course, chose to keep France in the Allied orbit.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later about how Vietnam plays into this Truman Doctrine. But what a time then, 1947, Kirk. I mean, in the spring, you have this Truman Doctrine saying, basically, we're going to support what he called free peoples around the world. And then in the summer, you've got the Marshall Plan.
Yes, and the Marshall Plan was a much harder sell. The Truman Doctrine actually got through Congress in about a month and a half, by April 20th, 22nd, something like that. The Marshall Plan took until early 1948 for Congress to buy into, because it was a much bigger commitment, and not just in terms of dollars, but clearly a commitment to all of Europe. And it's funny because Marshall, of course, had a sterling reputation, and just the fact that Marshall was behind it was important. But they also needed to know what exactly the costs were going to be and how the Europeans were going to play a role in this, because the Europeans were supposed to come to the United States with requests. And so the exact meaning of the Marshall Plan had to be worked out. And it actually wasn't worked out until after the coup in Czechoslovakia in early 1948, where the communists took power. And that seemed to crystallize in the ideas in the minds of a lot of Americans that, in fact, the Soviets were expansive and they would use fifth column means to overthrow legitimate governments. And I think we have to remember that when Truman's talking about armed minority, this is just 30 years after the communist revolution in Russia, where an armed minority had taken over Russia in the midst of a chaotic revolution. And so this rang true to Americans. And they had seen it in Hungary in 1919, and they had seen minority governments in 1945 imposed by the Red Army. And then when it happens in Czechoslovakia in 1948, they say, okay, this is how the Soviets work. They don't need to conquer. They're experts at undermining institutions. And then that plays out in the Red Scare. Well, they might be doing it here at home, too. They could be teachers. They could be in the movie industry. They could be in the State Department. They're everywhere, because that's the way communists operate. So it fed into the Red Scare as well.
So, Bill, Kirk mentioned 1948, the Soviets are adept, as he said, at taking over certain countries or making governments more in their favor. Why didn't the Truman Doctrine protect countries like Czechoslovakia, like Hungary, like some of those other Eastern European countries?
The Second World War ended with Soviet troops occupying those countries. And so the Soviet Union had a huge amount of influence in those countries, and it was really up to Stalin to decide how much choice the peoples of those countries would have for their governments. Interestingly, as we're talking about the Truman Doctrine, it's really if you look at the Soviet documents, really a Marshall Plan that strangely for them seemed the aggressive, scary move, and it precipitated a lot of their clamping down on their what would become their client regimes in East Central Europe. Because we think of the Marshall Plan as this huge act of generosity. In many ways, it was. It was enlightened self-interest for the United States. But from the Soviet perspective, when you're offering this aid that you're going to tie these countries together, that's threatened their potential hold on Eastern Europe.
All right, we'll talk more about the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and how it's relevant today in just a moment. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
Ah,
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, 70 years since the Truman Doctrine, launching a policy where the U.S. would intervene to stop communism and, as President Truman put it, support free peoples. We're looking at how relevant this is today, especially given that large numbers of Americans say it's time for our country to stop being the world's policeman. What do you think? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Kirk, to that point that you made earlier about the Truman Doctrine really sets up that statement that we always hear, you know, leader of the free world versus it's time for us to stop being the world's policeman. Those are the two themes that we hear. Bill said something earlier that after World War I, America retreated again, that our normal posture is isolationism, and that's what makes this Truman Doctrine so different. I wonder if there was a push for America to be a little more Truman-esque, if I could put it that way, after World War I that flunked.
Yes. Yeah, so when Woodrow Wilson asked for a declaration of war, he framed the speech with the most memorable line of his presidency, and he had a lot of memorable lines, but to make the world safe for democracy. And then when the war ended and he helped negotiate the Treaty of Versailles, after having laid out 14 points, which was about 1918, which was about America's commitment to the world and to national self-determination, and particularly in Europe, not around the world, the Senate rejected the Treaty of Versailles and rejected membership in the League of Nations, which was the core of Wilsonian foreign policy. And so the U.S. Senate did not like the terms. They weren't inherently opposed to the Treaty of Versailles, but they didn't like the way Wilson had negotiated it, got out of the Treaty of Versailles and had to sign a separate peace treaty and did not join the League of Nations. In the late 1930s and early 1940s, the debate in the United States then was really about foreign policy, at least, was had the mistake been 1917 getting in the war or 1919 the way we got out of the war? And FDR tried to say that the mistake was 1919. The war was not a mistake. It was actually the way we had ended the war. But the isolationists, who by far dominated in Congress and the American people, said, no, the mistake was getting in the war in the first place in 1917. We shouldn't have gotten involved in European problems. It was not a threat to American interests. We were basically protecting the bankers rather than protecting some sort of global interest that America stands for. And FDR was losing that debate on the eve of Pearl Harbor. He was making some progress with Lend-Lease, but I don't think the American people were swayed. But he did do a really important job following up on Wilson of laying out the idea that Europe is actually our neighbor. And so in his most important speech, probably of his entire presidency, the Lend-Lease speech in late 1940, he basically defines Britain as America's neighbor, not a country 3,000 miles away, but our neighbor. And he says, when your neighbor's house is on fire, you lend him your garden hose. And then if the garden hose is smashed up, he gives you a new one. And so we're going to lend them the material needed to put out the fire in Europe because they're our neighbor and we like our neighbor. And then when the war is over, they'll just give it back to us. They'll give us back the tanks and the airplanes and the bullets and all those things. And it was a very important part of his strategy to define Western Europe as America's neighbor. And that made it a lot easier for Truman than to define the United States' role in Europe as a necessary part of American national security. What's in the speech that's also interesting is he basically says the British government has come to us and told us it can no longer keep up its commitments financially in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so, therefore, we have to do it. And I think instead of a reaction of the American people, well, the British government, they're the people who, you know, brought us 1776. We don't necessarily like the British government. They had FDR laying the groundwork that Britain is our neighbor. And through the Atlantic Charter and the Four Freedoms, FDR had done a lot of work in 1941 setting up for the American people the idea that our national security at home depended on what happened far away overseas.
Well, and helped greatly by a man from New Hampshire, right? John Wynant,
yes.
Former governor, ambassador to London. And we did a whole program a couple years back on that wonderful book by Lynn Olson,
yes.
Citizen of London, that talks about Governor Wynant's role in getting the U.S. involved in World War II. You know, I'm struck by what Kirk is saying, Bill. It's really a generational change then between these two world wars. The second time around, people eventually jump on what FDR and then Harry Truman is saying. Not only are we going to get involved in this war, but we're going to stay engaged in Western Europe. It's a huge change.
Yeah, it's a huge change prompted by huge events because World War II is gigantic, massive, costly, scary, and sort of a cataclysmic event. And then it's followed by the reemergence in the middle of Eurasia of this gigantic power, which really we had had a weird and sort of conflicted attitude, but generally we're a little bit nervous and scared about it already. And then we had allied with it against Nazism. But soon it's starting to look scary again. It's closed. It's totalitarian. It has this ideology that says it wants to take over the entire world and turn it into communist countries. It wants to maintain relations with you at the government level, but at the same time seems to support these communist parties that want to overthrow the government. And so that combination of geopolitical power in the heart of Eurasia, an army of 300 divisions sitting there, the army that, by the way, had been the main force that took on the Wehrmacht of Germany, coupled with this scary ideology, is a pretty doggone big prompt to rethink whether staying at home really makes sense for the United States anymore. And the other thing to bear in mind here is that people saw Truman, his generation, Acheson, the Secretary of State, and others, Marshall, they saw a connection between America's they were on the side of this sort of that Kirk was talking about that had been only nascent in the post-World War I period, which was, look, if we don't do anything and if the European economy goes south, that's going to be the birthplace. That's going to nurture totalitarianism again. And the result will be a bigger, nastier war down the road. So maybe it makes sense to make some investments now to prevent us having to deal with a World War III in a much worse geopolitical position than we would otherwise be in. So it's that forward-looking element of the strategy that's new and that has basically stayed with us ever since.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. And again, as we said earlier, part of the speech just focuses on Greece is in bad shape, Turkey's in bad shape, they need us. But part of it is this forward-looking, we better watch out for what the Soviets are going to do. Let's just hear a little bit from Harry Truman's Truman Doctrine speech again, talking about those forward-looking fears.
The seeds of totalitarian regimes are nurtured by misery and want. They spread and grow in the evil soil of poverty and strife. They reach their full growth when the hope of a people for a better life has died. We must keep that hope alive. The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedoms. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation.
Could almost be Kirk Dorsey, a warm-up speech for the Marshall Plan.
It was, absolutely. If I may add just a couple of quick points to Bill's earlier point about the history that changes after World War II versus World War I, we have to keep in mind that generation also lived through Pearl Harbor. So the idea that the United States was safe because of the oceans had been flipped on its head, and actually the oceans had been used as a way to attack. Admittedly, Pearl Harbor is a long way away, but it was easy to turn that into the oceans did not make us safe. And then, of course, the invention of the atomic bomb created the question of what if the next Pearl Harbor has a nuclear weapon behind it, then we cannot just wait behind our walls and hope that doesn't happen. I also think it's hard to quantify, but I think there's also something about the Holocaust that's in there, that really awful things are happening around the world, and does the United States have an obligation to get in and do something about it? You know, it's remarkable. There's a document I use in my U.S. survey class, Eisenhower writing back from Germany to the White House saying, basically, we need to send journalists and senators over to see these camps because people simply will not believe it, and we need to have a historical record. So clearly the leadership had seen this. It was burned into them that what happened in Europe was unimaginable. And there's some sense of guilt that the United States had not done something more quickly. So I think beyond the big picture questions of isolationism versus internationalism, there were those three specific events that helped Americans say, maybe we can't stay morally or defensively back in North America and just expect the best to happen. If we don't get out into the world, really awful things will happen. Those will be on us. And so then the Marshall Plan, I think, fits in because what the leaders of the United States knew was that Stalin was an incredibly brutal man inside the Soviet Union. Millions of people died. He would be the greatest dictator in terms of killing in history if it weren't for, well, Mao and Hitler. And that was the show trials in the late 1930s were well known. And so the idea that the communists would take over Western Europe, it was pretty clear the people in Western Europe who had opposed communism would be sent to some form of gulag pretty quickly. And so I think the leaders in the administration really believed that they were standing up for people who were their allies, who had tried to stand for good in the West. And they had an obligation to try to prevent that kind of totalitarian system.
Wow. So partly engendered this Truman Doctrine and Marshall Plan, partly brought about by practical realities that you don't want Eastern Europe to crumble, but partly out of a sense of guilt that we didn't step in sooner and then we saw the Holocaust with our own eyes.
And that something similar could easily happen under Soviet regime. I mean, you know, they didn't know the full extent of the gulag, but they had seen the show trials. They'd been covered in Western newspapers, and they knew the people by the hundreds of thousands, if not more, were being basically sent out for simply being in opposition, and many of those people had been executed. And, you know, so the brutality of Stalin's regime was pretty well known, even if the full scale of it wasn't known. So I think they understood that in those countries, as an example, when they had Soviet POWs that had been captured by the Germans, they did not want to be repatriated in many cases back to the Soviet Union, in part because I think they understood that if they got sent back, they were not going to be welcomed back as POWs who had suffered for the motherland, but they had been people who had been tainted by their experience in Nazi POW camps. So I think they understood the nature of the brutality of the Soviet regime in its way of keeping order.
Again, the number for you to join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at the Truman Doctrine, 70 years old, launching a policy where the U.S. would intervene to stop communism. President Truman said it was about supporting free peoples. We're looking at how this guided U.S. foreign policy for the past seven decades and whether it's still relevant today. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Bill and Kirk, here's an email from Logan in Exeter who says, Truman and his congressional lackeys were scare and warmongers who created the modern national security state we live under. His base expansion policy led us into ever-tangling alliances, conflicts, the expenditures of trillions of dollars. Logan says it is no wonder we have always been in a constant state of warfare since World War II. Logan, thank you for the email. And William, what do you think?
That's a great question. And in some sense, it's true. It's the origins of the national security state. It's the origins of the United States' global role, a global role that did indeed incentivize the United States to get involved in wars, big ones, costly ones, horrible ones. For example, it's hard to imagine if we didn't have a containment policy and we weren't following the policy that followed from the Truman Doctrine, that we would have been involved in the Korean War or the Vietnam War or smaller wars during the Cold War. So he's got a point. And then, of course, it's quite true that the large centralization of power under the U.S. president, the gigantic national security apparatus, really began to develop in the war, but was further developed after the war. But the question that he and everyone should ask who make that argument is, what would the alternative have looked like? The world we have, it doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. Interest or even the world's interest would have been better off if the United States had refrained from undertaking these very, very costly endeavors. And there's no question about it. The United States has a tendency, all countries do, by the way, we're not the only ones, but we have a tendency sometimes to overdo it, to go too far, to take, to overreact, and as clearly happened in the case of Vietnam, where this idea that you see in the Truman Doctrine of this a domino theory that communism is going to spread like this virus, you know, we just took that to extremes and fought a very deadly war, and ultimately we're fighting it mainly to try to preserve some sort of prestige or credibility that we felt was necessary in a nuclear age. So the bottom line is, yes, a very, very costly policy. One should never look away from that. But you have to ask what the alternative would have been. And it's a tough historical question to do, to unpack where we would have gone had we not done that. And you can always argue about it. At the end of the day, though, I happen to think that the counterfactual world that would have emerged if the United States had not done this would have been much, much worse for the United States and could have actually pulled the United States back in to the world under much worse circumstances than 1947, the date that we're talking about.
Go ahead, Kirk.
Well, I'd also question the whole characterization of his lackeys in Congress. The House of Representatives was Republican at this point, so they didn't love Truman. They had a different take. You could look at Robert Taft in the Senate, Mr. Republican, who was an isolationist. Truman had to convince people in Congress that this was a real crisis. And they did not just follow him because he was the president. There was a lot of back and forth. Senator Vandenberg, a long-term isolationist, met with Truman beforehand and agreed with him, but said, you know, you do have to scare hell the American people to make it clear that this is a real threat to convince the American people. And I completely agree with Bill. I think if we run the counterfactual, if we run, say, President Wallace instead of President Truman, it's easy to see a situation that turns out much worse. But of course, we don't know what that situation is. So what we see is the Vietnam War and we see the Korean War. But even the Korean War, while we could say this was a terrible war and what, you know, a lot of Americans died, it's hard to imagine a situation where if North Korea conquers South Korea, the unified Korea turns out to be better than South Korea is today. And so South Korea, for all of its flaws, is a functioning democracy. And again, Taiwan, you know, is a functioning democracy. There are a number of states that were not functioning democracies in 1945 or 1949, whatever you want to start with, that effectively evolved into functioning democracies and because of American protection. So, and I think we need to keep the score sheet on both sides. And it's easy to see the excesses, and it's sometimes harder to see the successes because they don't often come at the cost of a war. They come because of policies that are much trickier. But I think Logan's general point is absolutely right, that without the Truman Doctrine, we would have had a very different foreign policy. Maybe it would have been better, but I tend to agree with Bill. I think it probably would have been worse.
Logan, thank you for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Fred's in Sanbornville. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me. I wanted to share my experience. I was a soldier in Germany, a U.S. soldier, from 1976 to 1978, and often along the Czech border, and I even went through Checkpoint Charlie into East Berlin in those days, and so forth. And when my 2 years in Germany was over, I came home, and I, you know, so that the experience was behind me. But later on in my military career, I would go to Saudi Arabia in the Gulf War in 1990, and then Baghdad in 2006, and then. When I, you know, reflected on that, I realized that when I had come home from Germany in 1978, that I actually decompressed from it was like being in a real war, the Cold War. And not only was it like a real war, the Soviet Union lost and we won.
So, Fred, the tension along those borders that you talked about, you know, even though now we look back and we say, you know, we're not sure how scary it really was, you felt it when you were there.
Well, it was scary. And my aunt lived... I happen to be German descent. I became a U.S. citizen when I was 10 years old, and I'm German. And so, of course, but my aunt lived, you know, not far from where I was. I was in Nuremberg, and she was, and my four first cousins in East Berlin. I would never meet them until I was 40 years old.
Oh, wow. What a story, Fred. Thank you so much. And, you know, Kirk, first of all, just what do you think of Fred's story? And then I have another question for you.
I think Fred's story, it's interesting, particularly in the 1970s, we think of as a time of detente. In the Carter administration, you'd think it was less than, but if you're a soldier on the front line and you've been told the Red Army might come storming through the Fulda Gap at any point, then you can't really say, I'm sure it's fine now. But I think it's also a useful reminder, and this maybe comes back to Logan's email, if you were to go to Hungary or Poland or Czechoslovakia, countries that scrambled to get into NATO as fast as they could as soon as the Berlin Wall came down, they would tell you that the Truman Doctrine was right on because that they had been oppressed by the Soviets. And the reason they want to get into NATO is because they want American protection against Russian expansionism. That's much older than communist expansionism. So I think we can see in Eastern Europe that the governments there basically were the product of the Red Army. And as soon as the Red Army lost its power, those governments were thrown out and the people voted with their feet to get out of the Warsaw Pact and into NATO to get protection from the Western Alliance. So they were saying basically the right side, we want to be on the right side of the Cold War.
All right. Well, perfect setup for what we're going to talk about after the break, which again is, you know, given the fall of the Soviet Union, given the new threats that we face today, should we still be following this Truman Doctrine? Let's hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in the Exchange, 70 years since the Truman Doctrine, President Truman's speech in 1947 that established the policy of American intervention against communism abroad. And a few months later came the Marshall Plan aimed at rebuilding Western Europe after World War II. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. In an era where many Americans say they're tired of this country being the world's policeman, how do we feel about this Truman Doctrine? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Bill, so let's fast forward again to today. Putin is doing his thing, but the threat of global communism seems to have receded. We face terrorist threats. People are worried about that. They don't know where the next one is going to come from. Why do we stick to this Truman Doctrine and have, you know, sort of Cold War-esque bases all over the world?
Because it makes the country safer. I mean, at the end of the day, the problem is that now we don't have an international, transnational movement of communism. But we have a lot of other transnational threats. We have a lot of other problems that are easier to solve if you happen to have allies and much harder to solve if you don't. I mean, one way to think about it is let's just take sort of a basic thing that most Americans would probably agree with and that we probably want, which is, you know, it's probably better to have a world with fewer nuclear countries than more. And the fact that the United States has these alliances prevents many countries from becoming nuclear. You know, Donald Trump during the campaign, I think, said without really thinking too much about it, was like, hey, maybe we should get rid of the Japan Security Treaty and Japan can secure itself with nuclear weapons. That would be awesome. The only problem is that would indeed probably happen. Japan would probably acquire nukes. But then what happens to Japan's neighbors? How does China respond? How does Korea respond? How does Taiwan respond? Then today you start seeing a proliferation of more and more nuclear states. And it's very hard to imagine that the world is safer for Americans with 15, 20, 25, 30 nuclear countries than it is today. So that's just one example of where maintaining these alliances, keeping the influence that those alliances give us, the tools that they give the United States to influence the world, make the United States safer.
These alliances, though, Bill, some people would say feel dusty, you know, again, based on this old menace that isn't there anymore. And that, you know, if you don't need to get rid of them, you at least need to rethink them. They're based on an old world order that doesn't exist anymore.
One should always, you know, look to make sure that you're modernizing these alliances and making them work. The thing is, there has been a lot of modernizations. There have been a lot of work to transform these alliances to help us with contemporary threats like terrorism. Look, we can debate about whether the United States should have been in Afghanistan or shouldn't have been in Afghanistan, but we were in Afghanistan, and we were in Afghanistan with allies. You know, General Mattis, who's now the Secretary of Defense, visited Dartmouth a couple of years ago. He was here 3 weeks ago. He was here for 3 weeks a couple of years ago. And somebody asked him about, you know, what good is NATO, you know, in a world of terrorism? And he said, I'll tell you what, fighting in Afghanistan with 40,000 allied troops is better than fighting in Afghanistan without 40,000 allied troops. They do a lot. They do a lot more than people recognize. When 9/11 happened, we took that security cooperation, which already existed within NATO, and we simply transformed it into security cooperation, into counterterrorism cooperation. So we already had the networks. We already, in some sense, knew whom to call. We already had the loyalties and the connections that had built up all over the years. And those were available to us like a resource the minute a new problem, a major challenge came. Now, the question you have to ask people who think we should pull back is this. If we pull back and get rid of all these allies and some new threat comes where we actually then need allies, how easy would it be to recreate this system of partners and allies that we now have in the world? I actually think it would be pretty hard to do. And it may not even be possible to do, which would, again, leave American citizens much less secure than they are today.
Go ahead, Kirk. I love your thoughts there.
I would agree with that completely. I'd also say that really what the Truman Doctrine is about was not about protecting freedom. It was about protecting market access with the belief that countries that were capitalist would ultimately turn into democratic states, that capitalism and free market exchanges, people could protect their interests, they would create a middle class, the middle class would want democracy. I mean, in some ways, we're talking about this in big, broad terms. Is China going to turn into a democracy because it's become capitalist? I mean, who knows? And maybe it's a ridiculous debate. But it seems to me that if we look at the Truman Doctrine as a method of maintaining American economic access around the world, we could see it perhaps the way Logan, the emailer, saw it, as this is sort of America imposing itself on the world. Or we could see it as a belief that I think the American leaders had at this time, The countries that are trading with one another openly almost never go to war with one another because they get what they want via trade, and war is a rolling of the dice. You might have a bigger army, but you still might lose because you have a dumb general or the weather is bad or something happens. But yeah. In trade, more often than not, particularly Americans who have faith in their business savvy, Americans will win trade negotiations. And this is, I think, where Trump is really challenging the orthodoxy of the Truman Doctrine, that we have lost the trade negotiations and that the foreigners are fleecing us. Here in New Hampshire, we, of course, are the site of the Bretton Woods Agreement from 1944, where all the Allied countries sent delegates to Bretton Woods in June of 1944. It was black fly season, so they had to stay in and negotiate rather than go out and enjoy the scenery. And they came up with a series of things like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, convertible currency that was fixed to the dollar, which was fixed to gold, so that everybody had a level playing field. And the United States was, in effect, as one European said, the locomotive, and the Europeans were the boxcars being pulled by the locomotive. On one hand, this could be portrayed as sacrifice by the United States, and that's how Richard Nixon saw it in the 1970s when he started breaking up the Bretton Woods Agreement. But on the other hand, it could be seen as serving America's national interests, that free trade, free relatively, opens up opportunities for people here and abroad. It makes it easier for democratic states to emerge. And we don't go to war with democratic states. We trade with democratic states. And so that's a matter of national security. And it's also a matter of prosperity. A prosperous world doesn't want to go to war. So when Truman is saying totalitarianism comes from the seeds, is planted in misery, totalitarianism leads to war. They had seen that in the 30s and 40s. And so the way to bring a more peaceful world is to integrate the world economically in effect, a free market democratic system.
Well, and that's the whole thinking behind the European Union, France and Germany getting together and saying, you know, we've been fighting a lot recently.
Yes.
Let's form an economic union and maybe we'll trade instead of fight.
Exactly. And it's almost impossible to imagine those countries going to war now. And it's also worth remembering that it was the Europeans that invited the United States to form NATO. The Americans were interested, but the Europeans formed the Defense Alliance in 1948 and then came to the United States and asked the United States and Canada to make it a truly North Atlantic agreement. So it was not just the United States pushing this on the Europeans. The Europeans were as interested
as we were. I want to ask both of you guys about NATO, but let's go back to our listeners for just a moment. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Karen's calling from Lebanon. Hi, Karen. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I think that the Truman Doctrine was also the first time that access to oil, maybe in particular, was identified as part of our national security interests. And I was curious if I'm remembering that correctly, but also if the speakers could talk a little bit to that. And also if there is an alternative doctrine to the Truman Doctrine emerging these days, or if it's too early to tell.
Well, great questions. And let's take the first one first. Bill, I'll throw it to you. Did the Truman Doctrine really focus on access to oil as part of our national security? The actual speech didn't, but I wonder if there was a subtext there.
Well, back in those days, the United States produced far more oil than we needed domestically, so we were kind of cool on the oil front. But it was Stalin, actually, who was really concerned about his sort of what he would thought of as a soft southern underbelly. He wants to protect it. He wants to get access to the straits that take you from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. And when he made his move into Iran the previous year, that was also about oil. So oil was figuring in it. And of course, the United States sometimes does care about oil markets, even if it is a net exporter, because it worries that if there's some interruption in these oil supplies, it could have ramifications for economic downturns that would then have bad geopolitical or political or security consequences. But I would see the main oil drive happening in this area is actually the one coming from the Soviet side.
That's really interesting. Go ahead, Kirk.
And I also wanted to add that Western Europe did not produce oil at this point. So oil, cheap and reliable oil, was really important for Western European rebuilding. They had not discovered the North Sea crude, for instance, yet. And Truman, I think, actually does mention briefly oil because he says basically the Middle East will be vulnerable if Greece and Turkey fall. And of course, oil was on their minds in 1947 as they're pondering what to do about Palestine, because Britain is pulling out of Palestine at the same time, turning it over to the UN. And there's a huge debate within the American administration whether or not to support an independent Israel or not. And George Marshall, who is opposed to it, one of the reasons he's opposed to it is that the Arab states that are producing oil will become our enemies if we turn to support Israel at a time when Israel is not really viable in Marshall's plan. Marshall actually says that if Truman supports the creation of Israel, he will vote against Truman in the 1948 election. That's how important he was. So he's completely opposed the U.S. support for Israel, in part because of the oil issue in the Middle East.
All right. So, Karen, great question. And go ahead, Bill. Yeah.
I was going to say, and many people might not know, but the first country to recognize Israel, working on the same logic, but from the reverse, was Stalin.
The other part of Karen's question, too, I like, and I'll throw it to you, Bill, I guess. She said, are there alternatives that you guys see emerging today to this Truman Doctrine? Maybe not, engage or don't engage, but some kind of alternative.
Well, there have been tweaks in this overall approach to U.S. foreign policy all through the Cold War and after the Cold War. Almost every administration tries to put a gloss on the implementation of its overall strategy of containment or global engagement. Now, I think the main – and even Obama, he was trying to rein us in after what was seen as a kind of overly ambitious strategy under George W. Bush, and trying to have a prudent, he sometimes tried to find names for like strategic patience or, a kind of prudential application of this strategy. Now, I think the main alternative people are thinking about is America First. That is the official name that Trump has given his foreign policy, America First. And that's simply an idea of saying, you know what, this whole idea of enlightened self-interest, that what's in our interest is often in other people's interest, and maybe we can all work together and everything's interdependent, is probably not the way to go about it, according to many speeches by Trump. But rather, we need to think about just narrowly, okay, what's the balance sheet for us? What do we get out of it? How much have you paid us recently? Where's the check from Germany for all that help we've given you over all these years? I want to look at this like a real estate transaction in every single bilateral relationship and ask, are we winning or are we losing in this relationship? That would be, by the way, as Kirk mentioned long ago in this program, they're walking away from some of this stuff, but were they to implement that, that would indeed truly be a new doctrine.
Although, listening to you gentlemen for the past hour, Kirk, a lot of this Truman Doctrine is based on American interest. Let's make sure that the economies of Western Europe are stable so that we can trade with them. Let's make sure that oil doesn't become a problem. So maybe it's written in different language, more altruistic language, but a lot of it's just, let's make the world safe for us and our businesses.
Absolutely. There was nothing altruistic or selfless about the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan. These were in American national interest. They helped other people, but that was because the Truman Doctrine, the Truman administration believed that this would help the United States in the long run, helping other people help the United States. And I think if there's going to be a Trump doctrine just a letter away or 200 letters away, it's that helping other people actually has hurt us rather than helped us.
The idea that we're spending too much on NATO bases.
Spending too much on NATO, foreign aid, the State Department, these are sort of waste. And we'd never get a Bretton Woods agreement under a Trump administration. Even NAFTA, which seems almost unchallengeable in the United States at some level, he's saying he's going to renegotiate that. But at the same time, it seems to me that the people he appointed to important positions like General McMaster and General Mattis have grown up in the Truman administration world and show no signs that they are opposed to the Truman Doctrine world. It's not so clear about Tillerson, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. But then again, I don't think he's as influential right now as Mattis and McMaster are. Trump has this odd affinity for generals, even though he campaigned saying he knew more than the generals. He found two that apparently know more than him. And I think they are very much in the Truman Doctrine frame that the United States needs allies, that we're better off with allies. So I think it's a venting of the spleen. And if Trump actually listens to his lead foreign policy advisors, he's not going to come up with a different doctrine.
Well, guys, it's interesting. We got an email from Logan earlier about, the Truman Doctrine is responsible for this overly involved American foreign and especially military policy. That was Logan's comment. And then we've got one from Jeffrey, who says, as much as I agree with the ideology of toning down the U.S. involvement in world affairs, I am far more convinced that it would be a vast mistake to underestimate somebody like Vladimir Putin and what he really wants. Nobody in the free world should for a moment trust this leftover relic from the Cold War. So Jeffrey says he doesn't think this is a good time to become less involved in Europe. What do you think, William? It's a really good point by Jeffrey.
Well, I think it's the case that Russia is far more challenging to European interests now. Russia thinks it's acting defensively. We're in kind of a situation that has glimmers, it's not quite as intense, but has glimmers of that Cold War situation where Putin thinks when he goes to bed at night, I'm sure, in the Kremlin, that everything he's doing to try to destabilize Europe, destabilize the West, destabilize the U.S. political system, that all those things he's doing are defensive for Russia to protect it. But they also have very, very damaging consequences. And if successful, would lead to a far more disorderly, dangerous, scary world for the United States. So in some sense, letting him succeed in his destabilizing efforts would be really bad for U.S. national security interests. And so to thwart that outcome, having a secure relationship with our NATO allies and giving them the confidence they need to stand up to these kinds of shenanigans remains a U.S. national interest. I don't want to overstate the Russian threat. I think it's getting hyped a little bit by a lot of people concerned about what they've done in the United States elections. It's a justifiable concern. I don't want to hype them up to Cold War levels, but dealing with Putin without NATO would not be as effective as dealing with Putin when we have this powerful alliance by our side.
Well, you said you don't want to hype it up to Cold War levels. Darn it, because I was just going to ask you guys. are we entering a possible new, okay, let's not call it a Cold War, Kurt, let's call it a Chile War.
Well, I think Russian national interests, as Putin perceives them, are definitely in direct conflict with American national interests as the people following the Truman Doctrine perceive them. Whether they're in conflict with Trump's vision of national interest, I think, is a little bit less clear. Whether or not Trump's actually going to carry through a picture of his national interest it's really still unclear this far into his administration what he really thinks about foreign policy. And so I think that the fact that the Russians clearly tried to meddle with the American election suggests that there's something on the verge of a Cold War. But the U.S. and Russia had Chile relations often before the Russians were communists, before the Bolshevik Revolution. There were clashes over interest in North America and were we on the side of Britain or were we not on the side of Britain, because Russia was often paired against Britain. So there's a long geopolitical history of U.S.-Russian roller coaster ups and downs. You know, we were good allies during World War II when we had a common enemy, and as soon as we didn't have a common enemy, then we stopped being allies. So I think right now, as long as Putin's in power, whoever's in power in the United States is going to be having problems. Cold War might be too strong a word, but certainly Russia does not have America's best interests at heart.
All right, both of you. Super interesting. Thank you so much for being here. William Wolforth, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you, Laura.
That's William Wolforth, again, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, co-author of the book America Abroad, The United States' Global Role in the 21st Century. Kirk Dorsey, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kirk Dorsey, professor of history at UNH. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.